It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. On the show today, what makes teams work when the stakes are low or incredibly high?
In a hospital setting, care is provided 24/7, and there are shifts of people coming and going. So communication is critical.
Julie Marath worked in hospitals for 40 years, first as a nurse and then as a hospital administrator.
And different disciplines that are involved in the care of patients have different vocabularies. So it's learning to talk to one another. Physicians, nurses, pharmacists, there's surgeon and anesthesia. And so the ability to listen, respect, talk to one another and not around each other is absolutely critical.
And while that kind of open back and forth between colleagues might sound obvious and very much expected now, Julie says when she got her first nursing job in the 70s, that kind of communication just didn't exist. She didn't even know it was possible. And she found her job very isolating.
Doctors talk to doctors, nurses to nurses, and people interacted around tasks, but not as a cohesive team.
So asking questions, raising concerns, speaking up about mistakes, it didn't really happen. Each person was kind of on their own.
It was lonely, you know. There's a lot of responsibility when you're caring for people. And I think that's was the predominant feeling, that if a mistake was made, if an error occurred, people went underground. They didn't talk about it. They didn't learn from it, but rather saw errors and failure as an inevitable part of providing highly complex, interdependent care.
She soon learned that this culture could lead to catastrophic results. And a warning here, Julie's story includes details that are upsetting.
A really early experience that I had was a child going for an operation, and the child died, and the nurse caring for the child never came back to work.
Julie says that maybe there had been an accident, maybe an issue with anesthesia. There were rumors, but only rumors. No one knew for sure what happened.
And no one ever communicated what happened to the child or to the nurse. It's haunting, even after all this time, that secrecy is so damaging.
What Julie saw was actually indicative of what was going on in hospitals all over the country. Widespread medical errors. But it wasn't until the 90s that researchers began looking into why these mistakes were happening. One Harvard researcher in particular.
I mean, if you really stop to think about it, we're dealing with very vulnerable people in very complex situations. So, of course, things go wrong. You know, the only question is, do we catch and correct them quickly enough to save lives?
This is Harvard Business School professor Amy Edmondson. Back when Amy was a graduate student in the 90s, she was studying organizational behavior, specifically teams and how they work. And her first project was to pinpoint why hospital errors happen, the kind of errors that Julie had seen.
I was invited to go into a couple of our teaching hospitals here at Harvard to study as part of a larger study of coordination breakdowns. And so I was, as a budding social psychologist, I was going in, observing patient care units, joining meetings where people were talking about how they worked together, what worked, what didn't work, and all the rest.
She wanted to understand why some teams seem to make more mistakes than others.
And my hypothesis is, I think this is obvious, I meant it to be obvious, was that the better teams, better coordination, you know, better leadership would have, ta-da, fewer error rates. But that is not what the data were saying. I had a reverse result. The data were saying that better teamwork was associated with higher error rates, not lower.
That must have seemed really strange to you, that the strongest, most motivated teams had the most errors?
Oh, yes. And my thinking starts literally spiraling out to, what will my next career move be now that I'm going to have to drop out of graduate school? So I calmed myself down and I thought about it. Well, what might explain this result? And of course, one possibility is that good teamwork really is problematic, but I just couldn't get my head around that explanation. Mm. And the more I thought about it, I was suddenly struck by a possibility. And the possibility was maybe the better teams don't make more mistakes. Maybe they're more willing and able to report the mistakes that happen.
Hmm.
Most of us don't like admitting mistakes, and I don't think they did either. But they were more committed to the idea that only by their willingness to admit mistakes could patients get the best possible care.
Hmm.
Then later I was able to show some evidence that this was likely the case, that they were more open, they were more honest, they were more sensitive to the nature of the work that they did.
Amy didn't end up failing graduate school. She actually went on to do decades of research and is now one of the world's foremost experts on teamwork. Her research is perhaps one of the main reasons why workplace culture has shifted its focus from individuals to teams. And decades after her first hospital study, Amy still says good teams talk openly about their mistakes, even if it goes against our natural instincts.
It turns out that no one wakes up in the morning and jumps out of bed because they can't wait to get to work today to look ignorant, incompetent, intrusive, or negative, right? No.
Here's Amy Edmondson on the TED stage.
No, on average, we'd prefer to look smart and helpful and, positive and helpful. So the good news about all this is that it's very easy to manage, right? Don't want to look ignorant? Don't ask questions. Don't want to look incompetent? Don't admit weakness or mistake. Don't want to look intrusive? Don't offer ideas. And if you don't want to look negative, by all means, don't criticize the status quo. Okay. Now, this strategy, the good news about this very successful strategy is that it works for self-protection. The psychologists call this impression management. And there's a great deal of evidence that we're quite good at it. We learn how to do this sometime in grade school. By the time we're working adults, it's all but second nature. Have you ever had a question and you look around and you don't ask it? No one else seems to be asking. Maybe you're supposed to know. You think, I'll figure it out later, right? So why does this matter? It matters because every one of these moments, every time we withhold, we rob ourselves and our colleagues of small moments of learning. And we don't innovate. We don't come up with new ideas. We are so busy, unconsciously for the most part, managing impressions that we don't contribute to creating a better organization. The nurses don't call. The pilot doesn't speak up. The executive doesn't say anything. So the good news is that not every workplace is, in fact, this way. There are some workplaces where people absolutely wake up in the morning, if not eager, at least willing and ready to take the interpersonal risks of learning. I call these special workplaces ones that have psychological safety. Now, I'll define psychological safety as a belief that it's absolutely okay, in fact, it's expected, to speak up with concerns, with questions, with ideas, with mistakes.
So can you tell me more about psychological safety? Radical candor was in vogue
yep.
for a little while, where you say,
yep.
whatever comes to mind, you put it out there.
Yes.
Kind of.
Sort of, yep.
But are there some sort of real basics that you think are crucial to creating that psychological safety in a team?
Yes, and in defense of radical candor.
Okay.
I think Kim Scott is very clear that she's not talking about brutal candor. Like what makes it radical is how unusual it is, but it matters to the quality of our interactions and ultimately the quality of our work.
Yeah.
Now, part of the way you build it is you call attention to attributes of the work that require us to be this way. Like if you're in a healthcare context, you say, you know, the complex interdependent nature of the work we do means that we are vulnerable. You know, breakdowns will happen. If you're a team leader, medical director in a setting like that, you are frequently making reference to the vulnerability of our processes to break down, not because we're not any good, but because it's literally the nature of the work we do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're an innovator in a tech company, you're saying, you know what? No one has ever done anything like this before. So we're trying something new here. Mm-hmm. All ideas welcome, and all critiques and concerns are doubly welcome.
Let me just suggest three simple things you can do so that that nurse does make the call. The pilot does speak up. The executive even reveals his concern about the takeover. First, frame the work as a learning problem, not an execution problem. Recognize, make explicit that there is enormous uncertainty ahead and enormous interdependence. We can't know what will happen. We've got to have everybody's brains and voices in the game. That creates the rationale for speaking up. Second, acknowledge your own fallibility, right? You know you're fallible. Say simple things like, I may miss something, I need to hear from you. This goes, by the way, for subordinates and colleagues, peers alike. That creates more safety for speaking up. And third, model curiosity. Ask a lot of questions. That actually creates a necessity for voice. And so these three simple things can go a long way toward creating the kind of workplace where we can avoid the catastrophes you saw coming.
So that is how to approach a high-stakes project. But what about when things go wrong? What is the best way to give feedback to maintain that psychological safety? You write in your latest book that leaders should be kind, but not nice. Please explain. What is the difference there?
Right. You know, when we say we're being nice, I'm not going to criticize you because it wouldn't be nice. I'm going to say, oh, that's, you know, really very good work when I actually don't think so. And the point I'm trying to make is that's not necessarily kind, or at least it's certainly not caring. Because if I cared enough about you and your future, I'd care enough to give you more honest and constructive feedback. And nice is the easy way out. And nice takes care of me, makes me comfortable in the moment, but it doesn't take care of you and it doesn't take care of the future.
I mean, that kind of stunned me a little bit in your new book. You talk about one way of diagnosing a healthy failure culture. You say, how much of this do you usually hear? And the list is, do you usually hear good news? Do you usually hear progress? Do you usually hear agreement? Do you usually hear all's well? And then you say, if you do, that's terrible.
Yeah. And again, context matters, right? Because
if you're on
the Toyota production line, that's probably okay, right? Because 99.9% of the time, it is all going according to plan. But if you're in a scientific laboratory and you're hearing, yeah, every single experiment is working just great, and I agree with you, boss, on every idea you had, you should be disappointed at that, right? Because that's not what a good lab looks like. Now, most of us are neither on the assembly line nor in the scientific laboratory. We're somewhere in between. And yet, even in the middle, I would argue that if you're only hearing the green and no red, it's probably suboptimal. It's probably a sign that people don't feel comfortable enough to say what's really going on.
Now, at this point in describing and teaching about these things, most managers I talk to start to get a little nervous, right? They say, I get it. I understand how this could really help people learn. I understand, and I want to hear about errors. But are you saying I have to dial back a little on excellence? Is it no longer possible to hold people accountable for great results, to hold their feet close to the fire? And I say no. In fact, when I'm talking about psychological safety, I'm essentially talking about letting up on the brakes, right? I'm not talking about the gas. I'm not talking about motivation. There's a lot out there on motivation, and it's really important, and it's important to understand it. But it's equally important to free people up to really engage and not be afraid of each other. If you're only talking about people's accountability for excellence and not making sure they're not afraid to talk to each other, then they're in the anxiety zone. Then that's a very dangerous place to be.
Yeah, and some people might say, well, you know, I've got college tuitions to pay. I just want a job. I don't really care about the end product. I'm fine with this. I'm fine with phoning it in. It's fine.
Yes, and I think that's a shame for two reasons. If I'm a customer, I'm thinking, this product's fine, but maybe it could have been even better. And organizationally, it's a real shame because what that points to is a leadership and management deficit where the organization's leaders or managers have failed to inspire you enough for you to want to give it your all. And they have failed to clarify that that's what good looks like, right? That there is almost no such thing as just play it safe around here. We're more disappointed in you if you're someone who never has a failure than if you're someone who has intelligent failures and learns from them and helps other people learn from them also, right? So it's I think it's kind of a profound thing, right? That is often not communicated.
I want to make sure I ask you, you know, somebody listening is thinking, am I doing this right? Am I running my family, my work team, my pickup softball team well? What are some questions they should ask themselves when it comes to taking the team forward for the win, you know, for the joyful win?
Yeah, I think the way you do that in your team or in your family is you articulate as best you can a sort of compelling aspiration for us as a family, as a team. And then you sort of raise with a curious mindset the questions of, like, what will it take for us to do this well? You make it a team problem-solving opportunity. You invite everyone in to be thinking about and co-creating the journey that lies ahead.
That's Amy Edmondson. She's a professor at Harvard Business School. Her most recent book is called The Right Kind of Wrong. You can watch her talks at ted.npr.org. In a minute, more about what motivates employees and brings together teams from the perspective of an investor who wants to change how companies incentivize their workforce.
When it works, this is the most amazing thing that can happen inside of a business, not only for the business, but for the people, for the community. We talk so much about inclusive capitalism, it drives me crazy, and this is it. Like, you want inclusive capitalism? Well, then people need to be included in ownership. That's it.
On the show today, what makes teams work? I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Stick with us.